This is an interview with the Reverend Marion Bascom for the McKeldin Jackson Oral History Project of the Maryland Historical Society on June the 18th, 1976 at the Douglas Memorial Community Church, Baltimore, Maryland. The interviewer is Richard Richardson. Reverend Bascom, please tell us something about your early life, education, involvement with civil rights, and your decision to come to Baltimore.
Well, I was born in Florida, educated at the local high school. I attended and was graduated from Florida Memorial College, and subsequently I finished Howard University. I've done some work at Wesley Theological Seminary as well as Garrett Biblical Institute on Northwestern University's campus. Immediately upon coming out of college, I became minister of a local church in St. Augustine, Florida, where my curiosity and concern for human rights began. It was here that, as minister of that church, we registered some 500 or 600 people in the small city of St. Augustine, Florida. In fact, I remember very distinctly that we were able to get a Miss Elsie to bring the books to register blacks into the first floor of our church. So that my interest has been in human rights. Of course, what else could you be interested in, being a part of the deprived and minority community? I came to Baltimore as a result of an invitation from this church, and for the past 27 years I have tried to serve it, and of course I have been pretty much at the heart and center of things with regard to the human rights, civil rights movement.
When, Reverend Bascom, when did you first meet Mrs. Jackson, and what were your recollections of those early years?
Well, I first met Mrs. Jackson almost the first week I came here, because Mrs. Jackson was a go-getter. Our church here is proximitous to the NAACP office. It was then located on the corner of Dolphin and McCullough Street, and right behind us here. And of course, this was one of the churches that historically had been supportive of Ms. Jackson. It was, as you know, one of the larger churches and had participated with Ms. Jackson prior to my coming, so that my falling in line with Mrs. Jackson was almost a must, as well as it was a kind of normal thing for me to do based upon the concerns that I had had previously.
Could you tell us something about the role of the church and its relations with the NAACP?
Well, Ms. Jackson just felt that the church was the bulwark of the NAACP, and hardly ever was there a meeting held outside of some local church. She always insisted that the church was the focal point of the community. She was oriented within the Christian framework, and she was very active. In fact, she was a trustee for years at Sharp Street, and so she used the churches, or better still, maybe the churches served as an available resource for her activities, and she never went outside of the church. The church was it as far as Ms. Jackson was concerned.
Could you tell us your personal reaction to the Supreme Court decision of 1954, and also how, if you could compare education before 1954 for blacks and education after 1954?
Well, in response to the first question, I was highly enthusiastic June the 17th, 1954, about the Supreme Court decision. I was at that time naive enough to believe that America was a nation that concerned itself with law and order, and I just said, well, the walls have come down. And of course, I think there were many other blacks who felt the same way. But as you know, it has been a long, drawn out, and the term deliberate speed has become a base incongruity as well as a misnomer, so that after all these years, it is still not in fact, it's on the books. Now, somehow, I have some reservations about education then and now. I think that those prior to 1954, and this is conjecture only, I have no data to support this, but I think that those youngsters who were educated prior to 1954 had a keener desire for learning, and although kids were segregated, I think that there was more of the herd psychology at work. However, since 1954 and the rise of integration, there have been some other factors. Television has come in the bowl. A restlessness has emerged. A permissiveness, if you please, has emerged, which, in my opinion, at this point, leaves a lot to be desired. Because I think and this is a generalization, I don't want to be held to it, but it's my own thoughts. I think that learning has to be reinstituted in the black community, a desire for learning, an appreciation for learning. There's some words that we've heard lately that I don't like anymore, relevant and irrelevant. And I'm sure that if blacks in America are to enter into a participatory relationship in the marketplace in America, we're going to have people who are knowledgeable about metallurgy, science, English, all the things that go along with civilization. That's my reaction.
Sort of what Jesse Jackson's been saying recently? Or?
I think I'm saying pretty much what Jesse Jackson has been saying. I think that more and more of us are going to have to do some in-house, and I stress in-house, evaluation and reappropriation of priorities and values. I think that there are some things that only blacks can do to blacks, because blacks basically don't trust white people, and there's reason for that, real reason for it. I find myself trusting less. This is a sad commentary, but I think the facts and figures will indicate my position.
What has been the role of the church in the areas of employment, housing, and voter registration in the last 25 years or so?
Well, again, we have, the church has served as the hospice for voter registration, the March on Washington. It was supportive of the Martin Luther King days, Southern Christian Leadership Corps, NAACP, And in that we're talking about Mrs. Jackson, you'll have to remember that the NAACP has substantially served more consistently in the black community than any other organization. And I think it's purely because the NAACP has attempted to deal with the problems in America judicially. And I think that here is probably where the action is. I think America has the capacity to do right, but it just doesn't have the will to do right. And if we are to continue to be a law-abiding nation, then it seems to me that although we thought that all the legal ramifications had come to an end, we're more sure now than ever that we've got to continue in the same direction, that is to win battle after battle in the court. We've just got to break down the break in half the backbone of discrimination. Now, I'm not talking about love. I'm simply saying that we've got to develop a wholesome respect for each other. I know that love is much better than respect, but until we can develop a climate in which we can respect each other, then that climate, it seems to me, will provide us the opportunity of going from respect to love, as far as people love.
What were your what are your first recollections of Governor McKeldin?
My first recollections of Governor McKeldin are kind of amusing. I first saw Governor McKeldin at Beechwood Park. He had on rundown shoes. He did not look like a well-heeled politician, but Governor McKeldin had a real religious fervor about himself, and there must have been something to it, because up to his latest days, he talked about the things moral, the things ethical, the things good, the things decent. And I would simply say that probably Mr. McKeldin was years ahead of his time. I still think of him deferentially and with great love and great respect. And interestingly enough, he was one of the first politicians to recognize the inherent strength the black community was possessed of. He was a good man. He was shrewd, but he was a good man. He was political, but he was at points non-political. I think that there were some things about the man that cried out for decency and morality and respect. And on this basis, I even went to his funeral. I guess there's one name that has not come up in some of the discussions, but there was a man, a black man in this community named Morris Calloway. Morris Calloway was a nondescript appearing person, but a man who really put Mr. McKeldin on his feet and taught him political savvy. And I think that you need to inquire more about Morris Calloway, M-A-R-S-E-C-A-L-L-O-W-A-Y. You need to inquire maybe of Bob Watts and Harry Cole and others about Morris Calloway. Reverend Arthur Payne, who is the retired minister of Enum Baptist Church. James L. Moore, who's minister of Sharon Baptist Church. You ought to inquire about Morris Calloway, because there is legend after legend about Morris Calloway and his relationship to Governor McKeldin.
Is Morris Calloway still alive?
No, he's dead long ago.
Was McKeldin sincere on civil rights?
I think he was. How can you judge a man whether he's sincere or not? He said the right things. He said them publicly. He said them in good company and in bad company, and God knows if you just had some people who say the right things, So in answer to your question, I think that the man was a decent, good man who transcended himself at points, because I think that he was basically a deeply religious man. If he wasn't religious, he knew how to quote the scripture. Of course, they said that even the devil can quote scripture.
What do you think was the source of his concern for civil rights?
As I've said before, I think his moral consciousness, his feeling for people, it's just like the reason that many white people don't like black people is because they've never known them, and they've known them in the master servant role. I'm often taken aback by the fact that people are surprised that blacks are articulate, can speak well, can think well, can write well, can teach well, preach well, and practice medicine well. We have been the victims of a subtle kind of psychology which indicated that blacks were inferior. You know, if you're white, you're right. If you're brown, stick around. If you're yellow, you're mellow. But if you're black, get back. So this has been the psychology. So that it is proved that blacks are equal in terms of their opportunities and to take advantage of those opportunities.
How did you feel about McKeldin preaching in black churches?
He was a good preacher. Any white man who wants to act decent and treat blacks as human beings is welcome in the black church. You see, it's the white folks who have this problem. We don't have it. They've got it. There's no black problem. It's a white problem that fails to understand that we are a part of the American dream. Although I know that we're no melting pot, but yet we are a melting pot, because in spite of the fact, I say this very frankly, black women didn't go around raping white men, and a multicolored black community didn't just come to being by intercourse within the community. So that, that's all I want to say about that.
Were you aware of any black input during McKeldin's term as governor? This would be from 1951 to 59. Was there much or any black input?
Oh, surely. There was black input. In fact, other than Mayor D'Alessandro, the most recent Mayor D'Alessandro, Governor McKeldin's office was open as mayor and as governor. People didn't have to have a sit-in demonstration to see Mr. McKeldin. Mr. McKeldin was available, and this, I think, made all the difference. He listened, and at times he couldn't do anything about what he heard, but at any rate, he was put in the position to articulate what he had heard in the right places, so that every mayor of Baltimore City ought to read his book, No Mean City, and catch the spirit of the No Mean City. And I think that you discover that Baltimore has the possibilities of being civilized. It is not civilized now, but it has the possibilities.
What were the origins of the Comprehensive Civil Rights Bill? This is the city bill of 1963, as far as you know.
Well, as far as I can remember, the origin sprang from the inequitable distribution of goods, services, opportunities, And as a result of that, the city and the state were called upon to do the right thing. It's like David Thoreau saying, nothing is so powerful as an idea whose time has come. And the time had come, and there were persons, and a person, who was willing to recognize the fact that the time had come. And you'll have to remember that this was not something that happened in Baltimore. It was a universal kind of thing within the American framework. Nothing happens in isolation. It was a national executive branch of government that was becoming concerned. It was Congress. It was CORE. It was Southern Christian Leadership. It was NAACP. It, you know, it was Rosa Parks that everybody's forgotten about, that really made the demand that the time had come.
Do you think, though, McKeldin being in the position he was in the 50s as governor and as mayor in the 63 to 67 helped matters?
Oh, certainly, without a doubt. You know, you can have a thing moving universally with people dragging their feet, but I think, as I've said before, that McKeldin did the best he could with what he had. And Baltimore will always be a different kind of Baltimore because McKeldin was here. Now, it would not have come as soon had there been someone else, I don't think. We would have dragged our feet on and on. But McKeldin recognized that he was dealing with some musts, M-U-S-T-S, and he abided by them. But I think more than that, he was willing to be a part of the engineering force to bring it about. And you can't do away with it, however you rationalize.
Why do you think blacks picketed McKeldin in 1963? I believe they did.
Well, we picketed Mr. McKeldin to lift up the problem because, as I said before, there were just some things Mr. McKeldin could not do. And there was always an understanding that, you know, it was a human kind, it was a human kind of thing to do. Sometimes you are forced to picket your friends, and friends understand why you're picketing them. They, in fact, to tell you the truth, now that he's dead and gone, he suggested that we do it. Simply to highlight a situation that he could not handle, which seems to give you a new kind of index that the man really cared.
When you say he couldn't do it, you mean philosophically or politically?
No. Philosophically, he had done it up here, but politically, what can you do? I mean, I don't remember, it's strange that I don't remember the men, all of the people who were in government then. McKeldin's the only one who sticks out. The little crumb crunches are forgotten, and it's McKeldin that you're asking me about this morning, which seems to indicate and to validate the fact that McKeldin was a real person.
That was my next question. I was going to ask you if during this period any other public official stands out in your mind on civil rights.
I think the two men who stand out in my mind are McKeldin and his successor, Tom and Alexander. I have a fond appreciation of him, his humor, and his willingness to do many things. For example, I was the first black fire commissioner in the history of Baltimore City, and I was appointed by D'Alessandro. So these two men stand out in my mind as being friends, not being able to do everything that I think they would have done, but the political exigences of the time demanded that they not be done, and just as is the case now.
Why have blacks left the Republican Party?
Well, they've left the Republican Party because the Republican Party is insensitive to black people. It's that simple. I ran for the presidency of the city council, and the powered Republicans gave me nothing but advice. And not only did they not give me advice, but they gave me no money.
Is there much of a Republican Party in the city? Do you?
No, there is no Republican Party in the city because the Republican Party is not concerned with the responsibility of having blacks to enter into a participatory relationship with them. And I suspect that I know about as well as anybody knows. I know they left me out on the string. They wanted to tell me how to campaign, what to say in the campaign, but they did not want to give me any money. In fact, I did not get $500 out of all the white Republicans in Baltimore City. One Republican told me probably the best thing he could do to help me was to discourage people in the third district from going out to vote.
Why do you think this has changed? Historically, as you know, the Republican Party, the party of Lincoln, the party that came out for civil rights,
That's very simple. The Republican Party has evolved into the party of the privileged. In fact, I don't know whether it's a party. And in a little while, after this election, we might not even have a Republican Party. So that I am very disillusioned with the party. I'm disillusioned with the white leadership of the party and the black leadership of the party, because I think they're game playing.
How about the Democratic Party in the city? How's that responding to the needs of blacks, do you think?
Well, it is, at any rate, is more hopeful than the other party. It's going to take a larger participation of blacks in the party. We're going to have to run more people. By people, I mean people, men, women. And we're going to have to look for new leadership. But the Democrat Party in this town is the best thing we've gotten. Might as well face it. In fact, I'm thinking seriously of changing party affiliations.
Was Mrs. Jackson very political?
Mrs. Jackson was political. I mean, look at all the folks in her family that are in politics. The Jackson-Mitchell clan has historically been a part of the civil rights political struggle, although she did not, actively politic. Yeah, Mrs. Jackson was a politician. You can't exist by being impolitic in a society. And politics, after all, is the orderly or the disorderly science of government.
How do you see the Jackson Mitchell family role in civil rights in the last 25 years?
I see it as being very human, has great strengths in it and weaknesses. It has ambivalences. It is a normal family. We're not talking about a conclave of saints. We're talking about an enclave of power. It just goes, when you think about Clarence Mitchell, chief of the Washington Bureau of NAACP, and go right on down to Mike Mitchell, who's the latest. Well, between those two, there's just a lot.
Why was Baltimore selected as a target city by CORE?
Well, because Baltimore is on, let us say, the main line between Miami and Boston. It's an in-between city. It's ambivalent. It has not discovered who it is. It's got a little of the suave, the politic, has a little of the ignorance. It's almost like a chameleon, so that Baltimore might well be the city to have been selected, based upon all of its advantages and disadvantages, and again, not to overuse the word, its ambivalence. I think all of this is a part of the reason that Baltimore was chosen. It's next door to Washington, the federal city. It's on the other side is Philadelphia, Wilmington. Below it's Richmond, New York. And then, of course, you've got the Montgomery Prince George County complex, the poverty of Western Maryland. What happened?